now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come to America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
How do you exhibit the love of Christ to a group of people who apparently want to kill you? Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Today we're going to talk about what happened on Friday the 13th in Paris. The terror attacks laid at the feet of the Islamic State, who are all too happy to take credit for that and everything else bad that happens in the world around us, part of their psyop, no doubt, to instill fear in the hearts of the kafir. That would be you and me, presumably. But as Christians, are we to respond with violence or with hatred, with prudence or with complete trust in the Lord? That's a difficult tightrope to walk. First and foremost, we'll discuss some of the geopolitical and military implications of what happened in the Middle East that day. Our guest is the author of the new book, Never Submit, a title that has significance when you understand that Islam means submission. Will the extermination of Christians get worse before it gets better? The subtitle of the book. The author is a Pentagon strategist, retired lieutenant colonel from the United States Army, frequent contributor to cable news networks such as CNN and Fox, and a gentleman that has been very gracious in allowing us to take up his time to discuss these issues, Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis. The attacks Friday night were a real jolt, and we've seen the French now making some calls for some changes in policy in Europe, even to the point of reinstating internal border controls, and of course they've taken some military action as well, launching airstrikes against the Islamic State's capital, Raqqa, in Syria. First of all, just to get your sense of the situation, what was the fact that the Islamic State, presumably the guilty party here, was able to carry out these attacks in Paris? Did that surprise you at all?
No, it didn't, Derek. I've been tracking this for years, and especially as ISIS, certainly for the last year and a half. And I've just published today my 235th report on ISIS. So I've been following it very closely. And of course, I've lived in Western Europe. In fact, my father still lives there. I've known about the increase of Islamists throughout the region and the violence associated with their failure to assimilate and the threat that they pose for the general culture. The fact that we've experienced over the last number of months a tsunami of refugees, some of which included ISIS sympathizers, and in fact, if you believe recent reports out of British newspapers, up to perhaps 4,000 of those refugees have been ISIS fighters themselves. We know that one of the suicide bombers at the stadium there in Paris on Friday night was carrying a Syrian passport that apparently he acquired on the 5th of October on a Greek island as he had fled to that island. And then subsequently, days later, he crossed Croatia and eventually into Paris. We also believe that this man, amongst others, were coordinating, based upon reports in the New York Times, with people back in Raqqa, Syria, allegedly the ISIS command, on the planning, the resourcing, the execution of the simultaneous attacks on six locations in Paris on Friday night. So, no, I'm not surprised. It is a war. It's one that we must recognize and immediately respond to. But unfortunately, given the stupid, naive approach taken by this administration in the United States, I fear that it will take events like what happened in Paris to happen here before this president will do anything meaningful.
Did you watch the Democratic presidential debate Saturday night? And if so, how did you avoid throwing a brick through your television?
Yeah, I watched some of the clips from that, and it was very difficult. They did not name Islam as center of this problem. No. They tried to obfuscate, responsibility. You know, I think if we're going to have the next president, we want that next president to have his or her eyes open to what the facts are on the ground. That's why I wrote Never Submit. Because, not only is there Christian genocide in the Mideast, but all non-Muslims are in fear. And even the Shia Muslims, who are not obviously Sunni, and now they're bringing that same intolerance, that same barbarian approach to life to Western Europe. And they will bring it to this country if we open our doors, as this president would have us do.
Yeah. The French, as I mentioned, responded immediately with strikes from their, I believe, was from their aircraft carrier, the Charles de Gaulle?
No, the Charles de Gaulle isn't quite in the Gulf yet. They had aircraft in UAE and in Jordan.
Okay.
And they obviously had refueling missions, but they went after four different types of targets in Raqqa, training facilities, which for some reason we haven't touched, command and control facilities, and depots and other types of activities, recruiting center and the like. These are targets that we should have hit a long time ago. There are, in fact, 60 different training facilities for ISIS in Iraq and Syria, turning out at least 1,000 fighters a month. So, as fast as we think we're killing ISIS people, they're regenerating, and they've got the help of a lot of people from overseas, to include some Americans that are going there.
Hmm. One of the things that surprised me was that one of the young men who's now being searched for by the, as we record this on Monday afternoon, by the French authorities, was recently interviewed by the Islamic State for its official publication, Dabiq, calling him Al-Belgiki, or the Belgian. Given that they're not making any secret of what they want to do and even who their guys are, why have the Western Europeans, and why do we here in the United States have such a difficult time just saying what they're trying to do? I mean, with a few exceptions on the left, guys like Bill Maher, who's no friend of Christians, at least recognizes what's going on. Why do the rest of us seem to have such trouble identifying the problem for what it is?
Well, the political correctness has inundated our culture and made us so scared of saying Islam is the center of this tragic situation. It's claiming the lives of a lot of innocent people. Our president and on down have refused to invoke Islam as a major problem here. They're saying it's a terrorism, or it's Islamist at the worst. You know, I was on CNN yesterday talking to Chris Cuomo, who was in Paris, and the issue of, what's behind this? What are Islamists came up. And we explain that, yes, they're people that believe in the 7th century prophet's radical teachings. They believe in beheading. They believe in sexual slavery. They believe in a host of other things, beheading, that, that they execute every day. And when you talked about, Derek, about Dabiq, of course, their magazine, named after the town where the final battle will take place between Christians, the Romans or the West, and the Islamists. That particular magazine is full of eschatological, statements about, what's the future going to hold, how they have to destroy Israel and the West, and how they're going to do that. You know, these people actually believe in what they're saying and what they're doing. And yet the West refuses to embrace the fact that Islamic ideology is something that is as intolerable as truly it is.
Hmm. Getting back to the military response here, obviously the French, as you say, attacking targets that we should have been attacking during the year plus that we've been launching airstrikes against the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. What should the next step be, given that the Islamic State appears to be really good at dispersing when they're under fire and very mobile in its tactics? I guess what I'm asking in a roundabout way is, have our military strategists in general adopted the kind of thinking necessary to attack an asymmetric warfighting unit like the Islamic State?
Well, you cannot defeat an asymmetric enemy from the air. You just can't do it. Now, you can pinpoint, like Jihadi John we got the other day with a drone strike from a Hellfire missile. But you know, ISIS has adopted. They know that, you know, we know where their facilities are, and so they move all the time. They are well dispersed. I seriously doubt on Sunday that the French killed all that many important people when they went after those four sites, even though they dropped some heavyweight bombs and, you know, supposedly surprise. But, you know, al-Baghdadi said, no, you know, we're going to be prepared. We're going to disperse. The only way to defeat an enemy like this is on the ground. You need air support, but you have to do it on the ground. Now, who's going to do that? Well, obviously, you know, the Russians have 4,000 people in country, some of which are on the ground, though they don't acknowledge it. And they're, you know, working with the Assad regime and some of their key allies. But if we want to destroy ISIS, and I think that they must be destroyed, it's going to take a coalition, and I believe the U.S. has got to lead. Now, the Turks have already indicated they're willing to join a coalition, but it has to be led, and it has to be joined by others. The Arabs aren't going to help much. Saudi Arabia is virtually worthless when it comes to fighting, other than, you know, among themselves in Riyadh. In fact, it's interesting, the Iranians threatened today that they would attack ISIS if they even come close to the Iranian border. And yet, I think that ISIS right now is not going to play with the Iranians because they know that they're serious. So if we want to destroy, as President Hollande of France has said, we have to build a unified coalition, and it has to include a lot of partners, much like the 17 nations that met today in Vienna. Foreign ministers got together, and they were trying to chart a roadmap for a resolution of the civil war in Syria. Well, I don't have a lot of confidence in them, much less in the Russians who are with them. But if we want a solution to this, and we need one soon, before it metastasizes even far more than it already is, then we've got to go in there, and we have to remove this scourge.
What's the risk of creating an incentive for more young Islamic men around the world to flock to Syria if we put boots on the ground?
Well, you put boots on the ground, much like we did in 2003. I think when President Bush sent troops in there, you know, we did instigate a civil war and an insurgency that was unnecessary. You know, I worked against that behind the scenes, and yet the Bush administration said they knew better. So as a result, we had a civil war, we had ISIS created and the like. This time, we have to be very careful. Yes, a civil war has already been going on for more than 4 years. So what we're going after is one element of that civil war. And of course, that didn't dictate who's going to end up in charge. Likely, if Putin has his way, the Alawites under, you know, either under Assad or under another, you know, similar butcher, will continue to have authority in Damascus, because I think that is almost inevitable unless you want to somehow remove the Russians from the equation. Mm-hmm. No one said this is a simple situation. It's incredibly complex. But, you know, I said earlier today, I think about a contingent of 100,000 well-fortified, plenty of air cover. But you're going to have to go into a lot of small villages, a lot of towns, and you're going to have to clean out the barbarians. And that's essentially what you have. Mm-hmm. Then you've got to take over the cyber part. You have to shut them down, their social media. And then, of course, you have to be aggressive across the world where they've already seeded many of these wannabes through radicalization. And there are a bunch in the United States, and we know that. And in fact, today they threatened to attack Washington, D.C. in a publicized video. So there are a lot of issues here. I address a lot of those and never submit. And at this point, I think that our president, though I don't expect him to do any of this, I think he's going to kick the can and expect the next president to do it. And we just need to hope and pray that we have someone that is willing to listen to those of us that understand the threat and are serious about following through.
It's one that hits close to home for a lot of folks. It hits close to home in our family. We've got a young man who is, and I won't identify which side of the family or wherever, but he just recently graduated and is now an active duty U.S. Marine, and maybe one that will be called on. in this this effort. The G20, as we talk, meeting in Turkey right now, and given that most of the pictures that we've seen, the handshakes of various heads of state are just photo opportunities, and the real heavy lifting is being done behind the scenes by persons such as yourself, having to figure out strategy, how do we actually accomplish what we want to accomplish, and recognizing that the presence of Russia and Iran on the ground in Syria, Hezbollah on the ground in Syria, complicates things. We've already got a handful of special forces troops in Syria or on their way. If we put more on the ground there, how difficult does it be to avoid a situation where somebody drops a bomb on somebody else's forces and the situation blows into something much bigger?
Well, I would start by establishing a no-fly zone and a no-ISIS zone so that refugees that are fleeing the violence would find safe haven. And that could easily be in northwest Syria. The Turks have been calling for that for some time, but President Obama has rejected. As far as deconflicting, of course, we already have a red line with Moscow trying to deconflict our aircraft flights. And it has been nip and tuck. So have the Israelis with the Russians. That's something that has to be well coordinated. But once you have a no ISIS zone established, then you can begin combat operations. And I would basically use terrain features and say, okay, Russians, you've got all the terrain on this side, and this coalition will take all the terrain over here, and will deconflict along the boundary between the two any air or ground operations, which there probably won't be a lot, especially if you make it a well-defined terrain feature. And then, you know, just methodically go after ISIS. Now, as soon as you start this, they're going to spread like rats off a sinking boat. Mm-hmm. And so you have to make sure that the Jordanians, the Turks, the Iraqis, their security forces, the Saudis, and even the Israelis and Lebanese are prepared for the infiltration of radical Islamists. Now, I think that that's doable. But certainly before you put a large ground contingent, that has to be an understood proposition. And I think that those nations will cooperate. But then, you know, once you have them in place, you know, kind of blocking actions throughout the region, then you go in methodically into every single nit and cranny, every hole in that part of the world and chase them out. And if they don't surrender, then you have to kill them.
Hmm. It's not rocket science. There's no trick, special strategy here or tactic that will make this easier. It's basically going to come down to the guys, the basic soldiers going in there and one by one putting themselves in harm's way in order to get this done.
Absolutely. You know, you can't turn the entire desert into a sheet of glass using napalm as we did in Vietnam or even nuclear weapons. What you have to do is to clean it out. And like anyone that goes in and cleans out, you know, a home, you have to look in every corner. You have to scrub hard some places, but eventually it will be clean. And unfortunately, because there are innocent people in the midst, innocent people will die, and that's always happened in war. We don't want that, and they will hide behind the innocents. So it's going to be a very, very tough fight, and because these people have demonstrated an unwillingness to give up, as we saw the other night in Paris. They blew themselves up when they ran out of ammunition. Well, yeah. These people will do much the same. So they believe in what they believe. Their ideology is firm. Their view of the future and their cause is, in many cases, very clear to them. They expect to go to paradise for sacrificing for their God. Well, I think we should help as many of them as we can.
Mm. Shifting gears a little bit and drawing on your experience as a resident, you know, someone who lives in or has lived in Western Europe, and you say your father still is living over there, you got a little better insight into this than I do. I just wonder how long the Europeans who still seem to be afraid of the the accusations that followed them after World War II, you know, the accusations of racism and genocide and so forth. But somewhere in Western Europe, you've got the spirit of the people who, you know, 1,000 years ago were, you know, the Vikings and, you know, the Saxon warriors and so forth, who basically kicked the Britons out of Britain and kicked the, you know, the Celts out of Europe. How long are the Germans, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Swedes, and so forth, the French, you know, the Franks, who basically took over all of Europe, you know, after the fall of the Roman Empire, how long are they going to allow this kind of thing to go on before far right groups like the political party that is led by Le Pen in France rise up and start taking action in their own hands?
Yeah, Marine Le Pen said the other day that France is not safe any longer. And it resonates with a significant part of the population. You found many groups, even in Germany, that are growing sick of what Merkel has done in that country. You know, there was a demonstration on Saturday that is support of the refugees in Hamburg. 6,000 people showed up. But I've been in contact with a man in Hamburg, and he said, look, 80% of the Germans have no tolerance for what Merkel has done. Yeah. That's why her popularity is in the toilet right now. I've been talking to a guy that lives on the Austrian border in Germany, and he says, well, you know, maybe it's been a bit exaggerated. But what I'm finding, as I look around from Sweden all the way down to Croatia and Greece and east to Germany and Poland, or east to Hungary and Poland, is that there is a growing dissatisfaction with the political class, that they don't understand the real problems. They're draining their economies. In fact, the new prime minister of Poland said, no more refugees. We're not taking any. The Swedes have closed their border. Of course, the French have temporarily. The French are especially a bizarre situation in that Hollande has called it a war, but he refuses to call ISIS ISIS. He calls it Daesh. And because it takes out the name Islam, even the mayor, I heard her when I was on CNN the other day, declare that we're not against Muslims. You know, we're just against these extremists. Well, if you don't call, if you don't know your enemy, like Sun Tzu, the Chinese military theorist said many years ago, you have to know the enemy and know yourselves, and then you're not going to be fearful of 100 battles. Well, the French, I'm not sure really know their enemy. I'm not sure here in America we really know our enemy, and yet we face a situation where I believe they're growing in our own ranks, and we're not aware of it and much less prepared to resist.
Is this an existential struggle for the nations of Europe?
Well, I think it is existential because many of these people that, you know, you've got about 6 million Muslims in an 82 million population in Germany that failed to assimilate. Now, when you look at the demographics, one of the reasons that Merkel has invited outsiders in is because the demographics of the German population are pretty old, and they need young workers.
Yeah.
And they've gone through two similar immigration periods before, and those have worked out reasonably well. This one's very different in that 80% of the people immigrating are young men. And when a refugee comes into Germany, it's expected that in a few years they'll bring maybe 3 or 4 others with them. And then, of course, their fertility rate is incredibly high. The German fertility rate, on the other hand, is about 1 per couple. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about, according to a organization in Bavaria of municipalities, that you're probably going to talk in another 5-6 years as many as 20 million Muslims in a population of 80 million. So the demographics of Germany could radically shift.
Yeah.
And if they all fail to assimilate, as we've found already, then you begin to lose culture, language, and obviously you don't have borders. So these are very significant altering. I suspect that the EU itself will come apart before, you know, we have this. And then, of course, you'll have just chaos in some of these areas. And, of course, there are nationalists in those countries, the Le Pens, or, you know, the Jörg Haiders that I talked to years ago that, you know, resisted this sort of thing, will start to pick up arms and they'll have civil war.
Mm-hmm. I hate to say this, but it may come to a day where the the Norwegian Anders Breivik, who killed all of those teenagers on that summer camp a couple of years ago, might be viewed by some in that nation as a hero because it was this sort of thing that he allegedly that he claimed was what motivated him to do what he did. The history of the world, has there ever been a time when bringing together people groups that are radically different, that don't want to assimilate with one another, has worked out well? I mean, forcing diversity into close proximity with one another. Are there any historical examples we can point to say, yeah, that worked out and was a nice, peaceful situation?
I'm not aware of any, Derek, and quite the contrary. You know, the reason why we had the Crusades and starting about 1032 is because after 300 years of Islamic radicalism, where they destroyed thousands of Christian churches, they took over, you know, most of the Christian world from North Africa, the Middle East, and Southern Europe. Finally, the last vestiges of Christianity, under the Pope's leadership, decided to go back and to try to open the Holy Land again, because they were being denied even access to the Holy Sepulchre, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. So I think that's a precedent that we may see today, in part because, you know, they truly are taking over Northern Africa, most of the Middle East. Unless we push back, are we going to push back? Is because of political correctness and because our leaders today don't have the backbone that's necessary to come to the defense of their own culture, much less their own faith.
Yeah. When we got political leaders saying or blaming this situation on climate change or the lack of jobs, it's clear that they've fundamentally missed the problem. The ultimate shape of Syria and Iraq, and this is more of a political question than a military question, but again, we've got diverse groups that have not wanted to assimilate for thousands of years. We're talking about the Kurds, you've got the Shia, the Sunni that have been fighting each other since, 650. How do we finally set, and of course, then you got the Christian communities or what's left of them in Syria and Iraq. How do we set up that part of the world with some sort of system that keeps the peace?
Well, certainly what the Brits did after the First World War didn't work with Iraq. It was an artificial country. And what we've seen here of late, where the Kurds are, you know, congregating in the north and the Sunnis in the middle and the Shia in the south, it just has never worked. The same thing with Syria. You know, you have the Alawites, you know, we're dominating a country of mostly Sunnis. And the tribal differences, the ethnic differences, the religious differences really do matter. And so you're probably going to have to balkanize those countries into a Kurdistan, which is something that the Turks have resisted. But you've got Kurds in southeast Turkey. You have them in Syria and Iraq and Iran. So those countries are going to have to come to some realization that, you know, maybe for peace and the future, we need to give these people their own piece of terrain. Same thing with those in Anbar province, the Sunnis, and of course the Sunnis that are in especially east of Damascus, and then give the Alawites a little sector of, you know, northwest Syria. If you don't, you know, they're going to continue the hatred, they're going to continue the fighting. And until the Lord comes, nothing's going to change significantly if we try to force them into these untenable situations that we have today.
Yeah, I'm no military scholar, and I don't consider myself an expert on geopolitics, but I've got pretty good reading comprehension. And so when we set up a constitutional government in Iraq and tried to set up a Western-style representative republic— in a nation that's majority Shia and had been dominated for years by Sunnis, it didn't take a lot of imagination to see that there would be problems when the Shias got into power and they were, you know, it was time for some payback. That's exactly what happened. We also, you know, predicted that we have created the new best friend for Iran, which is the only majority Shia nation in the world. The Alawites are like Shia, but not quite. Why is it that people like me and my wife, who, like I said, we have no foreign policy experience at the professional level, we could see this coming, and yet our governments in the West went and did what they did anyway and tried to impose it, in spite of common sense?
You know, during before 2003 invasion we did in Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, though a terrible dictator and very cruel to his people, at least it was a golden age for Christians. They were allowed to worship openly. They were allowed to have their churches. They were allowed to participate in the civil life. But of course, once we invaded and we created such a chaotic situation, the civil war was generated. And then we tried to impose our democratic understanding. Years ago, I was in at a conference in Western Europe, and I spoke about the post-Soviet Union and how it was Christian principles that were imposed that radically changed and ultimately, I think, brought about the end of the Iron Curtain. A Polish priest came up and said, you're right. But then a man out of Ramallah, Israel, came up and he lambasted me. He said, it's not Christian principles. He took it as denigrating Islam. Well, the fact is that the way in which the Islamic world views itself and those around it is so radically different from the Christian message. And yet our naive thinking politicians that say, well, we're going to go and democratize a country locked in the 14th century like Afghanistan, or one in that's been in terrible strife for hundreds and hundreds of years like Iraq, it's just not common sense. And yet they have no understanding of history. They have no understanding of religion. They have no understanding of just human nature, given what's going on there. And yet, you know, we've had leaders that would stand up and tell the American people, this is the way ahead. And then we just blindly sit back and allow this to happen. And we end up spending $1 trillion and wasting 4,000 of our young lives.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the tragedy of it, Bob. I have never served, but I come from a long line of folks that have been in this continent for over, well, going on 400 years and fought in just about everything, from the Indian Wars of the 1760s, the War of 1812, Civil War, World War One. It's been hard watching. And again, having family members who are in the service now and seeing what's taking place overseas. And sadly, it appears that there will be more young American bloodshed in order to try to clean up a mess that we have at the very least facilitated through our foreign policy there over the last 20 years. Well, we appreciate your expertise, your analysis, and again, your willingness to come on at such short notice here. I'll remind viewers that the interview with Colonel McGinnis about his new book, Never Submit, will be on Skywatch TV in just a couple of weeks, first week of December. And I think you'll be blessed by that and also blessed by the book. Colonel McGinnis, thank you again for your service and for your time today.
Thank you, Derek.
Look at the show notes for the link to where you can find a copy of Never Submit, the new book by Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis. And you'll find the show notes, as always, at vftb.net. Now, Because we're talking about some military possibilities and the hard reality that the only way to eliminate a group of people or to protect, let me put it this way, guarantee safety in the physical realm is through force of arms. And sadly, it appears that young Westerners, whether they're from the United States or not, will have to do the heavy lifting of literally going house to house through villages in Syria and Iraq in order to bring the Islamic State to its knees. And that's difficult to do because you're facing an enemy that would rather die than submit. Because for them, death is graduation to the realm where they're promised the 72 virgins who, a way to fulfill their every desire. I read it described this way, and this seems to ring true, that the Islamic State is a group that gives young men with a death wish a reason to live. And based on their actions to this point, that seems to be the case. Now, the events that took place were shocking. And here in the West, we've sort of become, especially if we've developed any wisdom at all about the media and about politicians, we understand that there is a rush to the cameras for those who believe in the maxim attributed to former Obama chief of staff Rahm Emanuel, now the mayor of Chicago, that you should never let a good crisis go to waste. Every point in the political spectrum is trying to spin the events of Friday the 13th to justify, rationalize, or support their own political position. And this is, again, from across the political spectrum. On the left, you've got people who say that this proves that Western imperialism is a bad thing because it invites this kind of blowback. To a degree, that may be true, but Western imperialism is not responsible for the death cult that is the Islamic State. And using the word cult is perhaps inaccurate, because as Dr. Timothy Furnish has pointed out in his research and writing, and not just since the Islamic State declared the caliphate, Dr. Furnish was writing about this in 2005, Radical Mahdism. I highly recommend his website, MahdiWatch.org, and he's got a couple of new books that are due out shortly, and I'll definitely have him back to talk about those when those are released. The Islamic State is going to try to kill you regardless of what the West is doing. That's just the long and the short of it. They believe the caliphate is destined to rule the world. And because you and I make up part of the world that they don't rule yet, they will want eventually to get us, our children, grandchildren, to submit if the Lord tarries. So you've got people on the left trying to, you know, use the events of the 13th of November in Paris to bash the evil Western elites for globalism or for their colonialism. All right. You've also got people on the left, like Senator Bernie Sanders, who's running for United States president, who believe that this is more proof that we need to take serious action on climate change, because it is the lack of water and natural resources and cropland and so forth that caused these guys to, you know, go all murderous on us. That, frankly, doesn't even deserve a response. On the right, you've got people like the former director of the CIA, James Woolsey, the current director of the CIA, who's sadly, his name is escaping me at the moment. Even the former press secretary for George W. Bush, Dana Perino, who's now a Fox News contributor, saying that the real fault of Friday the 13th lies with Edward Snowden. Yeah, Edward Snowden. Why? Because Snowden's disclosure of the depth and breadth of the National Security Agency's spying gave the strategists at the Islamic State the information they needed to elude detection by Western intelligence services. This needs to be addressed because it is patently false, and they should know it's false. Sadly, most of us don't have long enough memories to remember the mainstream media accounts dating back to 2001, before 9/11, documenting how Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups have known for decades to avoid electronic communication. I mean, maybe you remember in the stories in the wake of 9/11, trying to examine how something like that could have happened, pointing out that Osama bin Laden was able to keep his communications secret because he only used human couriers to send messages, never used cell phones, never used email, only human couriers. Why? Because they knew in 2001, in fact, they knew in the 90s, they knew in the 80s, of programs like Echelon, run by the National Security Agency and our Western allies, Canada, Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, that they were listening in. Western intelligence agencies were listening in on most electronic communications. They knew this 30 years ago. Edward Snowden's disclosures in the summer of 2013 didn't tell the terrorists anything that they didn't already know. What's going on here is that those on the right, like Perino, like Woolsey, and I'm going to have to look this up because it's driving me nuts, the current CIA director, I thought he would have his name on the tip of my tongue, and I don't, are trying to, John Brennan, are trying to divert attention from one of the key bits of information that you and I need to be aware of, which is that the Islamic State is essentially a creation of the United States and our allies in NATO. And it's the result of a number of years and a number of mistakes that go all the way back to 2003 when we invaded Iraq. When we invaded Iraq, we thought for some reason it would be a good idea. And when I say we, I mean the United States. United States military and the Bush administration thought it was a good idea to disband the Iraqi army and disband the Ba'ath Party, which was the political party controlled by Saddam Hussein. It was a Sunni minority governing a Shia majority inside Iraq. So career military men who had mostly Sunnis, the officer corps of the Iraqi army was Sunnis who were loyal to Saddam, had suddenly no place to go in Iraqi society because the Shias were now suddenly in control of the government because they make up a majority of the population there, and they were looking for payback. The Sunnis were imprisoned or persecuted or hounded and turned to the only alternative that was really left to them in this sectarian struggle that we unleashed by removing the lid from the pressure cooker, or by clamping the lid down on the pressure cooker. It's a bad metaphor. Forget that I said that. Anyway, by getting the strong man out of the way who kept everybody from killing each other, including the Christians, who, as Colonel McGinnis pointed out, enjoyed a golden age under Saddam. Suddenly the Shias, being the majority and enjoying what we in the West enjoy, a representative republic, were able to take over the government and put the screws to the Sunnis, who'd been oppressing them for years under Saddam. So we facilitated a sectarian struggle, which was exploited by other players in the region, including the United States, who saw it as an opportunity to take out the Alawite minority running Syria. Now, Alawites are not Shia, but at least they're friendly enough to the Shias so they can work together, which is why Iran and Syria have been allies for years. It's a Sunni majority in Syria. They've been under the thumb of the Alawite minority. And suddenly, by disenfranchising a bunch of career veteran military men, Sunni in Iraq, we created the core of the group that we now know today as the Islamic State. For a while, it was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And in the early part of the 2010s, 2011, 2012, we began, along with the Saudis and Qatar, supplying weapons to this group. And this is not speculation on my part. This is documented. Judicial Watch, the government watchdog group, obtained documents through the Freedom of Information Act that show in the summer of 2012, August of 2012, the Defense Intelligence Agency wrote a report warning about the danger of continuing to arm and support Al-Qaeda in Iraq because we were on the verge of giving them enough strength, enough military strength to create a Salafist, which is like a radical strain of Sunni Islam, a Salafist state, an Islamic state in Syria and Iraq that would destabilize both nations. That was in the summer of 2012, August of 2012. You can find that at the website of Judicial Watch. In fact, if I'll make a note, remember to put that in the show notes so you can see that I'm, again, this is not internet conspiracy theory. This is hard, cold, sad truth. We went ahead and continued anyway. In fact, the attack on the American consulate in Benghazi, Ambassador Christopher Stevens, it is believed, was there because he was facilitating the purchase and transfer of arms from the former, and then by that point disbanded Libyan military, and transferring them to ports in Syria to be handed to the so-called moderate rebels in Syria. Essentially, what happened is at some point in the early 2010s, the United States switched sides in the war on terror, and we began supporting Al-Qaeda because they were seen as a useful tool to drive Bashar al-Assad out of power in Syria. And the junkyard dog slipped its leash, became the Islamic State. That's basically what's happened. And so, back to my point, all points on the political spectrum trying to use the event of Friday the 13th in Paris to justify their view. Those on the left saying it's because we're bad and we're colonial, or because we're burning too much carbon. Those on the right saying, see, this is what happens when we divulge National Security Administration secrets, and we need more surveillance powers. Which, by the way, they got a couple of years ago, or a couple of weeks ago, when Congress passed the, what are they calling it, CISA, C-I-S-A, the new surveillance bill, which basically makes legal all of the unconstitutional surveillance stuff that the U.S. government is doing to American citizens. Now, having said all of that, it still doesn't change the fact that those people in Paris are still dead and their families are still grieving. So what do we do going forward? What do we do from here? I mean, it's this kind of a mess that we have created over the last couple administrations. Well, it goes back even further than that. I mean, look, Western elites have been using radical Islamists as pawns in their globalist games for decades. I mean, the United States created the Taliban, which then created Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan back in the 70s. So they could fight against the Russians in Afghanistan, which they did all through the 80s, finally drove the Russians out in 1989. So this is nothing new. I mean, heck, the Nazis in the 30s and 40s were partnering with the Arabs and the Muslims in the Middle East to try to eliminate the Jews and to try to, you know, frustrate the goals and aims of Britain and France in the Middle East. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem during the 30s and 40s, Amin al-Husseini, traveled to Berlin a couple of times, was a, I don't know if you call him a colleague, but at least an ally of Adolf Hitler, and helped the Germans recruit Bosnian Muslims into the Waffen-SS. So this is nothing new. The games that have been played with the West trying to use radical Islam for its own purposes. So I guess it's not surprising that some of this is going to come back on us. But the question remains, what do we do going forward? What do we do going forward? At the very least, I would hope, offer some sort of security to the few Christians who remain in Iraq and Syria. And where there used to be a couple million between the two nations, now we're down into the hundreds of thousands. Other stories in the news this past week, the Satanic Temple went public because, and offering to protect Muslims from backlash, using it as an opportunity to make Christians look very unchristian. Whenever you see a news story about the Satanic Temple, remember, it's the creation of one guy, a fellow named Doug Mesner, who's not even a Satanist. He's an atheist. He doesn't believe Satan even exists. But he's really, really good at sensing when he can jump onto a story and use it to get publicity. And his goal is, of course, to make Christians look stupid. But the irony for Mr. Mesner is that while he is an atheist, and this is per an interview with a former friend of his, a journalist, former friend, that he's being used as a useful idiot by the principalities and powers that he doesn't even believe exists. But just bear that in mind when you start seeing, you know, the Satanic Temple offering to do this, or Satanic Temple does that. There is not it's not a large group. I mean, we're talking maybe dozens of people all together, and all the press is being generated by one guy. That's not to say that there aren't actual legitimate Satanists who are working among us. I do give credence to the work of people like Russ Dizdar and Dr. Michael Lake. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't worry about Satanists. I'm just saying that this guy, the Satanic Temple, the reason he gets press is because he's very good at picking stories that will get people to click. And the media is very eager, always willing to publish clickbait. There's a story out of Indiana that is just coming to light now, even though it's not a new story, but the public defender for a 12-year-old girl is going public with her story to try to get her some help. She's from Elkhart, Indiana, fatally stabbed her stepmother months ago and set her family's apartment on fire. Young girl reportedly suffering from dissociative identity disorder, what we used to call multiple personality disorder. This is another Slenderman type case, except in this case, the young girl says she was motivated by a horror story clown called Laughing Jack. And again, this goes back to that creepypasta website where you essentially create horror stories. You're crowdsourcing horror, basically. People contribute stories and ideas and so forth, and you sort of build a composite backstory for a character that somebody creates. That's what Slenderman was. Laughing Jack is similar to that. And according to this 12-year-old girl, Laughing Jack told her to stab her stepmother to death and then set the apartment on fire. This girl has been as I said, diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder, also post-traumatic stress disorder. She's living in a juvenile detention center and has been turned down by, according to the attorney, 16 different psychiatric facilities and also the state of Indiana. The public defender, Holly Curtis, has been trying to get some help for her. And while I can't say this with 100% certainty because, A, I'm not an expert, and B, I'm not intimately familiar with the case, but just based on the details that have been released in the press, it seems to me that this is a young girl whose problem is less psychiatric and more spiritual, and that we're dealing with another demon that has assumed the identity of a character that a young girl was attracted to online. And we will probably see more of this. Looking forward to, I just got a copy, an advanced copy, and I need to really dig and start reading this. A new book by Reverend Dr. Robert Bennett called I Am Afraid. This is the follow-up to his book, I Am Not Afraid. Or actually, his new book is just called Afraid. The first book was about his experiences in Madagascar and discovering that exorcism and spiritual warfare are real. Demon possession is real. This takes that story, that investigation, a step further, brings it home to the United States and looks at what's going on here in the U.S. and examines it through a scholarly and theologically through academic rigor on theological grounds. Let me put it that way. So I'm looking forward to reading that. And right now we've got plans to get Dr. Bennett out here to the Ozarks in January so that we can talk to him about both books for Skywatch TV. I think that those are important works. You've got a Lutheran pastor, a denomination not known for spiritual warfare, being published by the publishing arm of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and saying that, you know, hey, this stuff is real. It's biblical and it's here in our own backyard. So looking forward to that. And one other note that Sharon and I will talk about more on PID Radio this weekend, because we are going to have a PID Radio this weekend. Pepsi has just released a short film called Black Knight Decoded. And if you're not familiar with the Black Knight, we will talk about that on PID Radio this weekend. It's a bit of UFO lore that is bits and pieces of other stories from the UFO community that have been cobbled together sort of into a legend, almost sort of the UFO version of creepypasta. it's allegedly a 13,000-year-old satellite that has been orbiting the Earth of artificial origin. And Pepsi has released a new film that features the Black Knight as part of the storyline. Now, why would they do that? Why would they, this thing suddenly, send messages to us from our space brothers? It comes across as soft disclosure. It also comes across as sort of a 21st century update of the old Coca-Cola commercial. I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony, la, 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 la. Yeah, it's sort of a globalist flavor on this Pepsi editor. But Sharon and I will talk about that on PID Radio this weekend. Coming up, well, again, we've got the Thanksgiving holiday, and then we are into the month of December. I've got some feelers out for some guests for A View from the Bunker. Dr. Ken Johnson among them. He's dealing with a bit of a cold, but hopefully come early December, he will be feeling better, and want to talk to him about his work. He's got a niche out there in the realm of Bible and prophecy scholarship. But he's written recently, recorded a brief teaching online, video teaching, about eating foods made according to Muslim dietary guidelines, and whether or not we as Christians can eat meat that has been prepared that way. So we'll talk about that and a few other things, but again, that's going to depend on when his gets over the cold that he's been fighting and can talk without having to strain himself too much. So that's all that's on the horizon that I can confirm at the moment. But as we get into December, we'll get a few more out there. May go to a lighter schedule during the month of December just because of the holiday season, but we're not going anywhere, and look forward to getting back to a twice a week schedule as we get back into January. There's an awful lot going on in the world out there, and it's easy to look at the situation around us politically and to see stories like the Laughing Jack tragedy in the news and just believe that the enemy is having its own way with us. But the Bible makes it clear that we're behind enemy lines, that the earth is in the temporary grasp of the God of this world, the prince of this world. But there is coming a day soon when Christ will return. And because God wanted us to remember this line, it's repeated twice in the Bible. It's in the Psalms and repeated by the Apostle Paul. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay. This week on Skywatch TV, we talked to Paul McGuire and co-author Troy Anderson. They've got a new book out called The Babylon Code, which looks at the role of secret societies in trying to make global government and global religion come to pass. Troy Anderson is the executive editor, or chief editor? I've got the title wrong. I think executive editor of Charisma Magazine. But he's a Pulitzer Prize nominated journalist. Okay, he's an investigative journalist with chops. Paul McGuire, Bible teacher, prophecy teacher. They got together, collaborated on this. Over 100 interviews went into the book. And that is the program on Tuesday on Skywatch TV. And then later that week, there will be a second web-only interview with Paul and Troy. So we've got an hour on Skywatch TV on the YouTube channel and the Roku channel with the authors of the forthcoming book, or the new book, The Babylon Code. And I think you'll find that interesting. Skywatch TV, if you can watch it, it airs 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday nights, 8:30 p.m. Central Time on the Christian Television Network. That's DirecTV 376, Dish Network 267, and the Glory Star Satellite Channel 117, right after Prophecy Watchers with Gary Stearman. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We do this because we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.